Hi, I'm Derek Jensen. This is Resistance Radio on the Progressive Radio Network. My guest today is Skip Rotstein. He's a retired high school biology teacher, the conservation chair of Friends of El Morro Elf and Forest in Morro Bay, California. He's participated in the restoration and maintenance of this 90-acre Pacific Coastal Scrub Preserve for the last 7 years. So first off, thank you for your work in the world. And second, thank you for being on the program.
Yes, thank you
for
inviting me.
Oh, of course. So I had never heard of something called an elfin forest until maybe 6 months ago, and I'm sure a lot of people haven't. So first, can you tell people what is an elfin forest? And then second, tell us a little bit about the El Morro elfin forest.
An elfin forest, in this case, is a oak forest that is very, very short. The belief is that it's because it's located on sand dunes that the trees are diminished because of the lack of nutrients in the sand, and the constant breeze from the ocean seems to shear off the tops. The oak trees are ordinary Pacific oaks, and they're the same trees genetically as trees a mile or two inland, which grow to as high as 50 feet. These seldom grow over 15 to 20 feet. The rest of the what is considered the forest is actually California dune scrub. And it's not much smaller than any dune scrub in any other areas along the coast.
And the elfin forest, it ends up that there, that this is a category that is not, there are other places around the world that are also called elfin forests. Is that correct?
I believe so. There's a there's a an elfin forest of some kind down in San Diego, for instance. But this is a specific one because of the oak, this is known because of the oak trees that grow here. This particular forest is right on the edge of the Morro Bay estuary. And it is subject to constant winds coming off the sea. And again, as I said before, it is believed to tend to shear induce a shearing pattern that is permanently stunted these oaks.
Go ahead, please.
Okay. The preserve itself is located at the edge of is between the estuary and suburban housing. The 90-acre preserve that is now a preserve was owned by a developer as recently as 40 years ago, who was planning on extending the housing tracks right to the water. And the people in the community got together to form an organization known as SWAP, Small Wilderness Area Preservation. This is a 401C that had actually had among its founders Ansel Adams, among others, back in the 1960s and 70s. And the local group became one of the then chapters of SWAP. We recently changed our name to Friends of El Morro Elfin Forest, since at present there are no other chapters of SWAP still in existence. They all became, all the other chapters became other independent organizations over the years. The community group that attempted to buy the Elfin Forest from the developer worked with the county of San Luis, Luis Obispo, and through community fundraising and governmental grants, a patchwork of grants, were put together to raise the approximately $2 million that it took to purchase the forest, which was then immediately donated to the county of San Luis Obispo as a county park. And at present, Friends of El Morro Forest have been operating the have been maintaining the preserve for the county, doing all the maintenance and preservation. The area had been badly abused by local usage. People were driving over it. People were walking down to the estuary, wearing trails through the sand. And over the years, a boardwalk has been built, a mile loop has been built, and all the sand trail, the extra sand trails were fenced off with green fencing, and there was replanting done. Tons of invasive plants have been pulled over a 20-year period. And now the area is looks like pristine coastal scrub, which it was up until probably about 70, 80 years ago. The community has continued to support the Friends of the El Morro Forest by having memberships and coming out on work days to remove invasive plants, repair the boardwalk, and maintain the trails by trimming along the trails. The Department of Fish and Wildlife is very interested in the area because we have two designated endangered species. One, the Morro sideband snail, and the other, the Morro manzanita, which has both of which have a very limited range, going a little north of the community of Morro Bay, which is just a couple of miles from us, and south. through Montana de Oro State Park, which is just a couple of miles to the south of us. So the whole 90-acre preserve is viewed as critical habitat. It's one of the last remaining refuges of these two endangered species.
So there's two possible... Thank you for that. And there's two possible directions here. One of them is... So this specific 90-acre preserve is what percent would you say of the entire that particular elfin forest? Is this the whole elfin forest, or is this half of it? Is this a quarter of it? How big is the entire, including unprotected forest?
Okay, the elfin forest is only along the fringes, the just up from the estuary, probably only the first couple hundred feet up from the estuary of the 90 acres. It stretches for approximately a mile along the estuary. I happen to live in an unprotected part of the Elfin Forest. In other words, I'm a block away from the western boundary. And I really love my home because it's a little remnant of the forest. There's nothing beyond me. In other words, I'm only a block away, and yet there's nothing beyond me. As you go inland from the 90-acre preserve, you immediately are behind, as you go inland along the band of oaks, which follows a stream leading into the estuary, you are immediately in a more sheltered area, and the soils are also different. In other words, you get away from the ancient sand dune soil that constitutes all of the elfin forest. And with better soils and with protection from the wind, the oaks quickly soar to that 40 to 50 foot height. So this is the only area where you have elfin forest. Also, in this particular area, this is probably one of the only protected areas where the local endangered snail is living. The snail probably is in pretty poor shape in the residential areas that surround the elfin forest and doesn't seem to be found further inland.
Well, that was actually my next question, is I was wondering if you can tell me, if you can tell me a little bit more about the snail and its life habits, how bad it's doing, its size, and just tell us a little bit about the snail.
Okay, the snail is a small, about half the size of the common garden snail. And the common garden snail is its fiercest competitor. In the residential areas, including mine, they've been entirely colonized by garden snails. I don't find, even though I'm in this small outcrop of the elfin forest, I do not find any endangered snails in my yard. The snail also has some close relatives farther north and farther south. In other words, the sideband snails are rather local. They seem to establish separate species in a very small range. So as you go a few miles north, you run into a different snail. I'm not aware that the one to the north or the one to the south is an endangered species. Ours happens to be a designated one. When we work, even calling, pulling invasive grasses or other weeds in the elfin forest, we're required to have a snail monitor present, a certified snail monitor. And that's sort of one of the interesting things. We also, when we do any other work beside that involves, let's say, digging or anything like that, in many areas, these are ancient Indian Native American camping grounds. So we're required to have an archaeological monitor and or a Native American observer, too. So this is considered critical habitat.
And have you seen a number of these snails in the preserve?
Oh yeah. No, they're not that uncommon. They're found. They're not found. Interestingly enough, under the oaks, but they are found in association with all the other scrub. I believe the oaks probably constitute maybe 20 acres out of the 90, roughly. And the snails tend to be in the other 70 acres where the which does not have dense oak growth. We have a narrow riparian band just below the oaks, all as I said, about with about a mile of shoreline. And no snails are found in that area. So the snails are usually up in the scrub area. And the reason we have monitors where we are pulling invasive grasses, one of which is all over the area. It's known as veldt grass. It's an invader from South Africa. The reason we have snail monitors is that the snails love to inhabit the root area, the base area around the roots of the viltgrass, the invasive species. So when we're pulling invasive species, we're very likely to run into snails. And the duty of the monitor is to pick up the snail and put it somewhere else.
And before we go on, can you talk just a little bit about the manzanita? Because I always feel like it's easy when we talk about endangered species to focus on animals and to forget plants.
Exactly. The Morro manzanita is very, very, very similar to the manzanita growing, the manzanitas growing all up and down the California coast. So if you're in an area that has manzanita and you go out and, and you're on the California coast and you look at it, you're looking at a species that's would probably be very hard to differentiate for a layman from the one we have. But it has been determined that ours has a very narrow range, as many of the manzanitas do have up and down the coast. There are a lot of species of manzanita on the coast. And our particular one seems to be only in the extremely sandy soils in our particular area.
Yeah, I was just looking it up, and it seems that the range of that specific manzanita is less than 900 acres. So that's an incredibly restricted range.
The 900 acres probably reflects the fact that it is living in an area that's been highly developed. In other words, the city of Morro Bay and the unincorporated area of Los Osos, which I live in, right across the bay from Morro Bay, probably were built on the central area where this manzanita lived. Fortunately, a great deal of this particular manzanita, beside living in the preserve, is just beyond the area of Los Osos, which is another California preserve owned by the state, and that's immediately adjacent to the rather large state park, Montana de Oro. The state park of Morro Bay State Park actually is just beyond the eastern boundary of our preserve. There's no elfin forest in the state parks, but they do have the Morro manzanita, and to a lesser degree, they do have the endangered snail.
You mentioned a creek. Are you too far south for steelhead, or are there steelhead there?
There are steelhead in our creeks. We have two creeks that feed into Morro Bay, and this is why it's an estuary. It's where the water meets the seawater, the freshwater meets the seawater. And we do have steelhead in both of the creeks. One of the creeks is heavily impacted by ranching, the one that is immediately beyond the preserve. There are no streams in the preserve, but the one that is, let's say, about a quarter mile to the east of the preserve is heavily impacted by ranching. It's got ranches coming almost right down to the creek. There have been efforts to keep cattle away from the creek itself, so that steelhead have been found in the pools going up for several miles. On the other hand, the creek that is a bit away from us, about a mile away, has steelhead that go up for many, many miles. And there have been tremendous restoration efforts alongside the creek by the National Estuary Program. And they've done a wonderful job of restoring habitat for several miles up the creek, working with the ranchers and the agricultural interests in that area. It's a heavily used agricultural valley that goes up about 10 miles to the city of San Luis Obispo.
So something you mentioned earlier is that the Elfin Forest only runs, I don't remember exactly how far, a couple hundred yards, I guess, from the ocean. It doesn't go too far. And I live up in Crescent City, which is on the ocean, far northern California. And
right.
Up until 20 years ago when I moved here, I'd lived all over the West. But something I find extraordinary that I did not know is the case with coastal areas that I just love is the fact that you can walk or you can drive or whatever 3 miles and be in an entirely different biotype. And, you know, I grew up in eastern Colorado and then lived in Idaho. And in Idaho, you know, it's North Idaho, it's miles of pine forest, or in Colorado, miles of prairie. But here, it's extraordinary. You can sometimes go, oh, a silly example is that if I went outside right now, I would be wearing a short sleeve shirt and everything's fine. And if I go a mile west, it's probably foggy and I would need a sweater. And that is reflected in the biotypes that happen. I don't know if you want to take this anywhere, but I just find it extraordinary how you can have these very, very, very localized biotypes, especially near the coast.
That's an excellent point, and that explains a great deal of why our area is very special. Right here in Morro Bay, I'm sitting here in I'm 100 feet from the water, and I'm sitting here talking to you in a sweater. It's absolutely gray outside. The temperature never gets above 65, except when we had extreme heat a while ago, and it got up to about 79 one day. But if I go, as you say, a mile inland or even less, the temperature immediately starts to rise. It can be 90 degrees 10 miles away in San Luis Obispo. And obviously, it can be 100 and some odd if you just go over the coastal mountains to the neighboring communities of Atascadero and Paso Robles. Right here, I've spoken of the fact that the soils were on ancient sand dunes, which not only are sandy, but have been worked so much that the soils, the sands are extremely fine and are in some cases almost impervious, impenetrable to water. So whatever rainfall falls probably washes off into the estuary pretty quickly. The climate here, on the other hand, while not having much rain, the fog probably provides most of the moisture that the oaks and the other plants get. There's only enough water for oaks, as I said, in a pretty narrow band of just a few hundred feet up from the more riparian willows and so on that grow in the fringe right along the water's edge. But the beyond the oaks, the coastal scrub is it almost looks like a desert environment. No cacti, but we do get some of the We get the manzanita as the most foresty-like plant, but then very quickly we're down to a lot of very small bushes and grasses.
So in preserving this area, including the estuary, has that helped, has that also helped birds quite a bit?
Yeah, we're one of the leading bird, we're right on the Pacific Flyway here. We get a tremendous number of migrating birds. Most of the birds that are attracted to this area are, because we're on the right on the ocean, are seabirds, or but we get a lot of marsh birds. We have a constant population of herons and egrets that live here all year round, which are seen from the preserve. And interestingly, overhead, and this is pretty common in central and northern California, overhead we have a resident population, a very healthy resident population of vultures. So if you lie down on a bench in the preserve and you happen to look up and see anybody circling above you, it might be one of the local vultures.
That's pretty cool. And this is not particularly important, but it's an interesting story about how amazing vultures are. I have a friend who, for whatever reason, they were cleaning out an abandoned building, and there was a freezer in it that had some very, very, very old and disgusting meat. And I was one of the people tasked with moving the freezer out. We moved it into a meadow, and then we popped it open. And within about, I don't know, 10 to 20 minutes, there were vultures circling overhead. And so I was pretty stunned with how extraordinary their sense of smell must be, because they were able to. So think about the molecules of rotting meat that when we popped it open, they have to disperse. And can you imagine the concentration, the very tiny concentration of rotting meat that got up to the vultures wherever they were, say 3 miles away? And I mean, they were able to respond so quickly. It's just, I've got no point. It's just utterly extraordinary to me how quickly they were able to get there.
I think that's a good point. What you did remind me, though, is by speaking of the birds in the area and the annual big sit, I think the location in the Elfin Forest that is used by the bird observers has come in something like second in the world with about 200 and some odd species within a 1 day period. So we are the water birds, we do attract a lot of other species. Again, many of them do migrate through, but we have a lot of residents also. The other thing that I was thinking of is that we have an invasive animal that is really a menace to the forest. In California, we have wild pigs that are dispersed throughout almost the whole state, except on the highest mountains and in the eastern deserts. These are descendants of domesticated pigs, but they, besides whatever escape these might have been, these are animals that were introduced many years ago as game animals in some areas, and simply have dispersed. We do not have normally a resident population in the open forest, but every couple of years, some of the pigs find their way in, and they have been controlled. And their favorite food, of course, are acorns and oak seedlings, and they just root up everything in the oak areas. And of course, if there are a future generation of oaks that is trying to grow up, that's all there is when these pigs come through. About 2 years ago, we had apparently a family took up residence in the forest, and we counted up to 11 of the large pigs. The males will run up over 200 pounds. So these are big animals. And the state park people who are immediately adjacent to us took action and through trapping eliminated the pigs in the preserve. However, I maintain a game camera that is on every night. And a couple of months ago, a young male pig appeared in the camera one night. And he's since made a reappearance just a couple of weeks ago. So we know he's at least coming and going into the forest. He's probably looking for a mate, and hopefully he doesn't find one, because they do have several litters a year. And if they take up residence again, we'll have to get help in removing them.
Well, thank you for bringing that up, because a lot of people that is, to me at least, a surprisingly contentious issue. So thank you for bringing that up. And then before we move on to the whole question of small wilderness, I want to ask you one more question about the Elfin Forest, which is,
sure.
So if you go back 500 or 1,000 years, who, including non-humans, would have lived there? And I'm wondering, especially when you mentioned acorns, what made me think of it, because I know that Southern California had a pretty large population of grizzly bears. So do you know what the place would have been like? Well, actually, a couple questions. One is, do you know how much bigger the forest would have been 500 years ago? Would it have extended a lot further north and south? Has a lot of it been destroyed, as you sort of hinted at, through either agriculture or urbanization? And second, who were some of the, especially megafauna, who lived there?
Okay, that's a good question about who lived here beside the Native Americans. The Native American population in the Elfin Forest, we know, was not a permanent population. It was a seasonal population. People came down, and we know they gathered shellfish, because from one end of the Elfin Forest to another is a huge is just littered with clam shells, oyster shells, and whatever. In other words, it's just a big shell mound. There are no permanent freshwater supplies in the Elfin Forest, so the people probably had to carry in water from streams maybe a mile or two away. The community that the Elfin Forest is located in, as I stated before, is known as Los Osos, which means the bears. And we have a beautiful, huge mural spread across one wall in the business area of town, which shows a visualization of the Portola expedition in 1776, walking through the area. And we know Portola did come through Los Osos. And confronting a group of grizzly bears. And the bears are towering over the soldiers who are firing at them with blunderbusses. There are historical accounts of the expedition finding a lot of bears in Los Osos and slaughtering them for meat at the time. The Indian population was spread thin, possibly also because this is an area where if the kids went out to play, they might be, you know, they might be dinner for a grizzly bear, even though the bears are not known to attack humans as a preference. But we do know that the Native Americans clustered in some areas for one reason being for protection against the large animals. We have no grizzly bears in the area now. We haven't had any reports of black bears in the Elfin Forest because right now their access to the Elfin Forest would be rather narrow, and it would be between ranch lands and suburban homes. In the Montana de Oro State Park, we do have black bears occasionally come through. We also have mountain lion sightings. And there has been a sighting of a mountain lion a couple of years ago, just beyond the boundaries of the Elfin Forest as you go inland up toward the ranch areas. So the fauna, the megafauna of just a few thousand years ago would certainly have included probably beside the grizzly bears, it would have probably included brown bears, although I'm not sure how the grizzlies and the browns get along. And it would have included mountain lions. Right now, and at some point in the past, probably wolves also. A very, very healthy population of deer, probably too healthy because there are no large predators present. We also have a population of coyotes, which probably keeps the smaller mammals, the rodents and hares. Quite apparent.
Did the area traditionally have? I'm going to ask a couple more categories of megafauna. Did you traditionally have elk down there? And then also, when you get to the ocean, do you now, and did you traditionally have various pinnipeds, seals, sea lions, etc., and whales too?
Okay. I have no knowledge if there were elks in the area, or even, you know, more inland pronghorn antelope. Interestingly enough, when you ask that question, we're about 20 miles south of the Hearst acreage, the vast Hearst ranch. And if you want to see exotic species, they have a large herd of zebras. So, you know, the area can accommodate all sorts of animals. As far as pinnipeds, Morro Bay is known as a home for about 30 sea otters. So our claim to fame now is that we are the southern end of the current sea otter range. This is all new because the sea otters were thought to be exterminated on the California coast until the rediscovery of sea otters in the 1930s up just north of us at Big Sur. They since have spread south into Morro Bay, and they're a real tourist attraction here, but they are not further south. Now, the Elfin Forest, we're about a mile from the mouth of the bay, and we're in an area that all along the shore of the Elfin Forest, as the tide goes out each day, it exposes mudflats that extend over a mile from the Elfin Forest. And the mudflats, at most at high tide, are covered with about 4 to 5 feet of water. So we don't get pinnipeds coming this far in the bay. We don't get sea otters. We don't get dolphins either, all of which are in the bay. In other words, the bay has a, beside the resident sea otter population, it has occasional dolphins, and then it has a large resident sea lion population that, of course, have taken over a few docks, and when they aren't chased off, they occasionally invade a sailboat. So I'm talking about an area beyond a 6 mile long sandbar. In other words, we're in an enclosed area with just one outlet to the ocean itself. The area beyond what we call Morro Bay, the larger bay, is called Estero Bay, and that extends for about 40 miles from Big Sur south. So that area, the open ocean, Estero Bay, is regularly visited by migrating gray whales. We get an occasional killer whale. We have plenty of white sharks. And as a matter of fact, the great white sharks are believed to be depressing the sea otter population. In other words, they don't come into the protected Morro Bay, but they're offshore, and they come as close as the kelp beds where the where the sea otters feed. But again, that's a little out from where we are at the preserve.
So we have about 7 or 8 minutes left, and
sure.
You mentioned before something called SWAP, and can you talk about the importance of, wait, is that correct? Small wilderness, SWAP.
Small Wilderness Area Preservation.
Yeah. Can you talk about the importance? I think you and I would both agree, right, that it's important to protect 100,000 acres or 500,000 acres or 1 million acres, large areas for large animals. Can you talk about the importance also of protecting small areas? Because I don't think that's talked about often enough.
Oh, okay. The major problem in coastal development in California has been that developers have realized, going back 100 years now, that it's wonderful to live along the coast, and so quickly there has been housing development and resort development up and down the California coast, leaving only pockets of undeveloped land. In other words, when you have this residential development, you have sometimes critical habitat. The only critical habitat that's left is rather small, and it's just for a very small distance inland from the coast. Two such areas in our Morro Bay area were the 90 acres that were left undeveloped. They were, as I said, they were badly degraded up until about 30 years ago, when the local residents working through this parent organization, SWAP, which was a tax-exempt organization, got to work to preserve this area. Prior to that, SWAP, SWAP, had worked to through not the local group, but the woman who had originally started the organization about 50 years ago, again, with Ansel Adams as one of the board members, had worked with the state of California to buy a oak preserve just inland from, excuse my voice, just inland from Los Osos. So, and there were a couple of other areas along the coastal part of California that did the same thing. We have a preserve not associated with us called the Fiscalini Ranch, 20 miles north of us in the community of Cambria, where a local rancher was persuaded to donate his family ranch as a small coastal preserve. It's a few hundred acres, totally surrounded by homes, but it's been maintained in a outside of the effects of grazing for the previous 100 years. Outside of the effects of grazing, it's been restored to a condition of pretty good coastal scrub. Not as good as the Elfin Forest, but it's still another excellent example of a small reserve of very important habitat.
And I guess one more, I mean, I think it's desperately important to protect small areas as well. And then another lesson to be learned from this, I mean, this was spearheaded by local people, right? So can you talk about the Elfin Forest protection was really begun as a local effort. Is that correct?
Yes. And I'd like to give credit to one local person. As a relatively young woman, Yolanda Waddell, who lives just two blocks from the Elfin Forest today, was one of the people spearheading the effort. And Yolanda, now 40 years later, is still a member of our board, puts out our newsletter, and is a leading light in the preservation of the Elfin Forest. The as I said, the group just recently decided to change the name to Friends of the Elfin Forest, Avail Moro Elfin Forest, to distinguish us from this Elfin Forest that pops up on the internet, but it's an independent group in San Diego. So the other thing that was very critical in establishing this preserve was the fact that the county of San Luis Obispo was very interested in having this park. And the county, however, accepted the park, the donation of the property as a park, under the condition that the local residents, as the SWAP group were, would do the restoration and the maintenance. And our group has done that to this very day.
So I think I would like to end with, can you talk about if somebody lives somewhere else that, and there is a place that they want to preserve, How would they go about starting? What would they? I want to encourage people to protect local places elsewhere. So, what would you say to encourage them?
Okay, I think that's a much easier process today than before, because in this county, in San Luis Obispo, as well as in many other areas along the coast of California, there are local land conservancies that have been started and in the last 20, 30, 40 years. And there's a very strong land conservancy here in San Luis Obispo County that has, for instance, purchased a large tract just above the city of Pismo Beach, which is 20 miles to the south of us. They're in the business of looking for properties, raising the money, buying those properties, either turning them over to a governmental agency, such as a county or a state parks, whatever, or actually maintaining those properties themselves. I know I participated in a conservancy effort in the desert area before we moved here about 10 years ago. So what I would suggest to anyone that has an area that they think needs preservation, go online and see if you have a local conservancy and see if they're willing to undertake your interested property as a project.
Well, thank you so much for that, and thank you for your work in the world for protecting that place. And I would like to thank listeners for listening. My guest today has been Skip Rotstein. This is Derek Jensen for Resistance Radio on the Progressive Radio Network.